Welcome to Public Historians at Work, a podcast series from the Center for Public History at the University of Houston. I'm Dr. Monica Perales, Associate Professor of History and Director of CPH. In this podcast series, we speak with academics, artists, activists, and community members about what it means to do history and humanities work for and with the public. In our second season, we're examining public history as it relates to medicine, health, and the well-being of our global community. For more resources on these topics and ways to support the mission of CPH, make sure to check us out at uh.edu/class/CPH or find us on Facebook and Twitter at UHCPHistory. Together, we can help reclaim our past.
According to Dr. Stephen Veeder, assistant professor of history at Cornell University, capturing feeling is just as important to public history as transmitting knowledge. Whether collecting an oral history or cultivating a museum exhibit, Dr. Veeder emphasizes the ethical responsibility to honor people's bodily and emotional responses to history. As he tells recent PhD graduate Timothy Vail in their conversation recorded on May 6, 2022, valuing the full human experience has played a key role in shaping each of his projects. This includes the 2017 exhibition, AIDS at Home, Art and Everyday Activism at the Museum of the City of New York, which explored how artists and activists have mobilized domestic space during the HIV/AIDS epidemic. Now, as the director of Cornell's Public History Initiative, Dr. Veeder teaches students that doing historical research with the public is more than an intellectual exercise, but a high-stakes and even personal endeavor that elicits emotion and contributes to the contemporary world. Let's listen in.
Dr. Veeder, welcome to the podcast, and it's great to have you here today.
Tim, thank you so much for the invitation to be here and the chance to talk some more.
Absolutely. To get us started and give a bit more background about you and your work, I figured we would first talk about your own academic research interests and what your scholarship focuses on for those who are unaware.
So my research focuses on history of gender, sexuality, home, and housing after World War II in the United States. And as you mentioned, I just published my first book, The Queerness of Home, published in late 2021 by University of Chicago Press. And that book traces the various ways that LGBTQ people have worked to reinvent home life and navigate and interrogate the politics of domesticity from 1945 until now. And really, in order to think more broadly about what the meanings of home and the politics of home in everyday US life. I'm also just starting a new project that kind of comes out of some of my work on housing and HIV/AIDS about sort of what happened to people in the 1970s and 80s after they were released from state mental hospitals as part of the move towards deinstitutionalization in the 70s and 80s, which is a kind of related story for me about housing, home, and belonging in the post-war period.
In addition to your scholarship, you have also contributed to a wide range of public history projects throughout your career as well. How did you first become interested in public history, and what were some of those projects that you worked early on?
I really appreciate that question, but it's always interesting to me because I think for a long time I was doing public history without calling it public history. Really, I think the first real entry for me in what I think of as public history work was when I was working on the dissertation that became The Queerness of Home, doing oral histories with people who had been in LGBT communes in the 1970s as part of that project, where I was really reaching out to a lot of activists who had formed these living collectives in the 70s as a way of that, as they understood it, of really interrogating gender and sexual norms and interrogating what family looked like and what family meant. And those oral histories, I think, I had been also a journalist before I went to graduate school. And so I'd always been interested in thinking about how I could take the research that I was doing and bring it to a broader public. But the oral history work, I think, engaged me more with a community of people in a way that I think is really central to public history. And really, I think, engaged me with kind of ethical questions and also the kind of trust building and relationship building that public history often really entails. And so those oral histories were really important for me. That also led me to get involved as a consultant, an on-screen scholar for a documentary that someone was making about one of the communes that I had been researching, a commune called Lavender Hill, that's actually was here in Ithaca, New York, where I live now. And that documentary, Lavender Hill, A Love Story, directed by Austin Bunn and Bob Hazen, was really helpful for me also in thinking about, again, how to take the work I had been doing and, again, how to translate that for a broader public. I think the real turning point for me in beginning to really think of myself as a public historian and kind of put all these threads together was a postdoctoral fellowship funded by the Mellon Foundation that I had at the Museum of the City of New York from 2015 to 2017. That was a real opportunity to understand essentially how museums operated and to also think again about the stakes of scholarly research when you're trying to bring it from your academic work to a broader public.
Yeah, and it's really interesting that you bring up your background as a journalist, and I was interested in hearing a little bit more about how your background helped your oral history work. Like, for example, when I started working with oral histories, I didn't have this kind of background. What kind of advantages would you say helped you do this kind of oral history work?
I think the biggest advantage for me was just the kind of confidence of going into a room and just starting to ask someone questions, which I think actually is not intuitive or easy right away. And to try to also to think about the work of trying to put somebody at ease and try to build trust with somebody often really quickly. And also to be able to think about the kinds of questions that you ask that are going to give people space to tell stories. I think the biggest difference, though, is that journalists, when you go into an interview, you usually have like a set of goals. You already have some sense usually of the story that you're trying to write. You know, often ask questions that are very goal-oriented or very information-oriented, where oral history, I think one of the things I had to learn was to try to ask questions that were much more open-ended, to really follow the participant much more and let them take the story where they wanted to take it, and to understand that idea that this is ultimately, this is their story, and they're sharing it with me, and I might draw on it in my research, but ultimately, this is their space and story to tell. That's a key difference, right, of actually kind of letting go. And I always think about this phrasing from Michael Frisch about sharing authority or letting go and following somebody else. And I think that's actually an important skill for researchers and scholars to learn generally.
Yeah, and on that note as well, sometimes when we do oral histories, we sometimes encounter maybe challenges that we don't often originally anticipate. Was this the same for you when you were doing these oral history interviews for Lavender Hill? Did you have any challenges that came up that you had to overcome?
I realized I had to develop a better understanding of like what people actually remembered and what they didn't. In writing about and researching communes, for instance, you know, a lot of people I was talking to had been involved in communes for like 6 months and they had written about it. They were really excited to be joining these communes. But then I would ask them things about the space, right? I'd ask them like, what did the space look like? And they may or may not have remembered really well. For me, that was the center of the story, was the 6 months. That was what I was interested in. But that wasn't the center of their whole story. That was one moment among many. And that's, I think, what I mean also about learning to do oral histories that were a little less information driven and understand better also how the archival research I was doing could complement the oral history work and vice versa, right? How these different forms of information might sit together. I think the other thing that I really had to come to understand better was that oral histories have a different type of research value, of historical value, that they're not the same as archival work. You can't use oral histories in the same way. I like the ways that actually doing oral histories bring the participant or the subject into the story, right? And give a little bit more narrative space to them in the research, in a way that I think that archival materials often don't as much.
Absolutely. And you can definitely bring a much more human element to a particular historical event that one's looking at. On that note here as well, I know that in addition to your oral history work, you've also been involved in several other kinds of public history mediums, in particular your work with museum exhibits at the Museum of the City of New York, as well as your short film and publications in the New York Times and Slate. you bring a heavy emphasis on not just your scholarly interests on gender and sexuality, but also the ways in which you use different mediums to interact with the public. For our audience, what value do you see in combining this public engagement with your own history research?
I think for me, what I really love about doing publicly engaged public history work is the ways that it has really helped me to understand the stakes of the research I'm doing. You know, I really believe that the histories that I'm tracing have significance for people in the present, both because of the kind of personal resonances that stories often have for people, but also because I think that looking at things like activism in the past often has important lessons for us in the present about how we strive towards greater social justice and equity in the present. The other thing I really value about doing public history work is where you actually are engaging with people directly rather than sort of imagining somebody reading your book. You actually get to watch them in the museum looking at an exhibit, which is a sort of terrifying experience, just so you know, to watch someone moving. It's like watching someone reading your book, but they're moving through the space. But I really also value the chance to see the emotional responses that people have. I think that we place so much emphasis on the intellectual value of our research, but I think many people engage with history in a much more bodily and affective way, an emotional way. And I like the way that public history draws that out. With the exhibits, I'll just say a little bit more. The first exhibit I worked on at the Museum of the City of New York was a sweeping exhibit called Gay Gotham that I co-curated with Donald Albrecht at the Museum of the City of New York. The exhibition looked at the long history of LGBTQ artists and communities in New York from 1910 to 1995. That was a very celebratory exhibit where it was the museum's first major exhibition on LGBTQ history. And it was really a way of celebrating, right, the creativity and the community building of LGBTQ people in New York City. That was just fascinating to watch. I think we really tried to build an exhibit where people could find themselves in it, right? Where to try to create an exhibit that represented the many facets of LGBTQ history in New York, and so that visitors could come and find themselves there. So everything from Harlem Renaissance artist Richard Bruce Nugent to lesbian feminist artist Harmony Hammond in the 1970s, you know, and to try to wrangle this very broad story, right, into a space, right, into a physical space and into works that people were going to be able to trace that story through. The other exhibit that I worked on after that was an exhibit called AIDS at Home, Art and Everyday Activism. And that exhibit was based on the last chapter of my book that I was finishing at that time, to look at different ways that activists and artists had mobilized home spaces as sites of community building and activism in responses to HIV/AIDS from the 1980s until now. And that was a very different kind of exhibit because I thought a lot about how to figure out the right feeling that we were trying to evoke, right? Because I think that these were stories that for a lot of people coming to the museum that I knew were very painful stories. And to try to find a way to give space for people to encounter some of that pain, but also to be in touch and to rethink some of the caregiving work that they had been doing, some of the work people had been doing around creating new kinds of family or creating new kinds of home, and to reframe that as really critical forms of political engagement in ways that home often doesn't get thought about as political. That was itself a really moving experience that required a lot of collaboration to put together.
Yeah, and you mentioned earlier how it's one thing to read a historian or an author's work, and it's another to actually be in a physical space or part of an exhibit that you have the public reaction. And so what were the public receptions to these exhibits? What kinds of emotions and reactions did you get from the people?
With Gay Gotham, my very favorite thing, you know, was watching people on Instagram. There are a number of pictures of Instagram where people would pose with artwork in the exhibition. So we had these beautiful photographs by Chantal Regnault of the ballroom scene in New York in the 1980s and 90s. And there were a pair of young people who posted an Instagram post sort of mimicking the poses of two of the leaders of the ballroom scene, right, just sort of posing with them. We also have these beautiful portraits by artist Zheng Guangqi, who was a close friend of Keith Haring, but also did this important series called Ambiguous Ambassador, where he would pose in front of the Statue of Liberty or the Twin Towers and kind of camping what it meant to be a tourist in New York and in the United States. Again, there was a portrait of someone posing in front of it, sort of mimicking Zheng Guangqi's outfit and pose. And that, for me, really brought home the way people really want to identify with artists. They want to identify with the past and feel the past in often really visceral ways. And, you know, when we talk about this as a celebration, it's a feeling that people also want to take on. I think especially for young people, is really important to take some of that feeling of pride, right, and ownership and connection to history. With AIDS at Home, I thought about two different audiences. One, I thought a lot about people in New York City who had been of a generation where they were directly impacted by HIV/AIDS. Either they are living with HIV/AIDS now, or they had cared for somebody with HIV/AIDS. That history is really closely connected to them. But I also wanted the exhibition to speak to a broader audience as well, because I think one of the things that's interesting about museums is that people come to the place like the Museum of the City of New York for lots of exhibits happening simultaneously. And so their audience is coming because they're coming to see New York at its core, which is the museum's long history of New York City, right? They're coming on a school group tour. And to think about people who are encountering AIDS at Home, but that wasn't what they came there for. And so I really tried to think with AIDS at Home about how to create a story that also would resonate for anyone who had ever cared for somebody living with a serious illness or had ever been living with a serious illness themselves, and to try to also give people a space to access some of those feelings. It's also, I think, a big ask to also ask people to bring up such feelings of pain and loss in a public setting. And so something else I talked a lot about with our exhibition designer, Marissa Martoni, was about how to create a space that people could feel comfortable being in. And so a lot of design of the exhibition was to create a kind of home-like space in the space of the exhibition. You know, one of the big differences, it seems small, right, between Gay Gotham and AIDS at Home is that we put in a lot more places to sit in AIDS at Home, right? We had a lot more places to sit down and watch a film, right? We had a lot of films from the 1980s where people had been documenting everyday home life. And we wanted those spaces to sit for people to also take a break and also slow down. And again, be in touch with some of those feelings. The last thing I'll say about AIDS at Home too, is that it was really important that it be an exhibition that went from 1980 to now. Gay Gotham technically ended in 1995. That was the timeline. But it was really key that AIDS at Home made clear that HIV/AIDS is an ongoing epidemic, and this is an ongoing history, that this is not a history with an end point, but one that we're still living in.
Right. And in addition to physical exhibits of AIDS from Home, you also co-directed a short film called A Place in the City that was featured as part of the exhibit. What was it like working on a documentary in addition to the exhibit itself?
The film, you know, something that we started talking about really early on, that as a film about the present, like a new documentary, essentially, that would end the exhibition. And that was a way of really making sure that people moving through this exhibition ended the exhibition with an understanding, again, that this was an ongoing epidemic that was still impacting people's lives and people were still fighting for greater health access and greater community. And so A Place in the City, which I co-directed with Nate Levy, picks up the three themes of the exhibition, caregiving, housing, and family, but brings it into the present through the lenses of three activists and artists working today, Ted Kerr and the collective What Would an HIV Doula Do on caregiving, Wanda Hernandez Parks and the housing activist group Vocal New York, and then Kia LaBeija, artist Kia LaBeija, and the ballroom community in New York City. So sort of three segments, each of them focusing on one of those people as storytellers and are kind of way into these different lenses of caregiving, housing, and family now. And what was powerful about working on the film was that it kind of took all of the challenges and skills needed for doing public history and added even greater urgency to it. Because again, doing essentially oral history interviews with people and filming them and needing to really build a sense of trust and safety, right, really early and really quickly with people. But with the added dimension that these are stories that are then going to be literally shown like a few months later. Also trying to think about how to translate the themes of the exhibition in a way that's going to be resonant. One of the inspirations from the film was also, you know, a lot of these 1980s documentary films that we included excerpts from in the exhibition, of going into people's home spaces. And one of the things that we tried to do in the exhibition is we're starting in each case with interviews with people like in their home spaces, with Ted and Wanda and Kia in their home spaces, and then moving out into the city with them. And what I love about that is this reminder that everyone we pass in a city has their own story, has a home life, and that's a meaningful and important, and that has a political valence to it if we think to ask about it.
You've also written several op-eds in publications like the New York Times and Slate. What was it like translating your own work into a much more mainstream publication type of setting like the New York Times?
Whenever I do write for a public audience now through the New York Times or Slate, I really tend to do it out of a sense of political urgency. And I think this is one of the challenges of writing these kinds of pieces, right? Of really trying to make really clear why the history that I'm talking about is so important for us to understand now. So, you know, one of the pieces I think about is a piece I wrote for Slate shortly after the 2016 election. It was really inspired by a photograph that I came across in the archive at NYU, in the Fails archive, that was a photograph of an activist in front of Trump Tower in October 31st, 1989, wearing a costume from The Wizard of Oz of Dorothy with a sign that said, "Surrender, Donald." I found this photograph because this was when I was doing research for AIDS at Home. And I came across this photograph in October of 2016, so a month before the election. And then the meaning of it really shifted, of course, for me after Donald Trump was elected. And so the piece I wrote for Slate was really trying to think about the meaning of activism for the moment that we were entering into with Trump's election. It also required a bit of a kind of investigative journalism there too, because I really also just had questions, right, about who was this person in the photograph that was holding this sign. And so I asked around and found out, you know, it was this, an activist named Ronnie Vigiani. And then I interviewed him about, was he thinking at that time? Again, the urgency and also the opportunity to bring a story like that to a general public really quickly. Another more recent piece I'm really proud of is an article that I co-authored. I've co-authored a number of pieces with my partner, David S. Byers, who is a professor of social work at the Graduate School of Social Work and Social Research at Bryn Mawr College. And we've co-authored a number of pieces that are connecting histories of social welfare and activism to policy and social work in the present. In last June, we published a piece in the New York Times in response to the Fulton v. Philadelphia case, which was a Supreme Court case where essentially a dispute between the city of Philadelphia and a Catholic foster care agency about whether the foster care agency could exclude LGBTQ parents as potential foster parents. And we had been working for a while and are still working on this project about the origins of LGBTQ affirmative counseling. And so we published an article a few years ago now on an early LGBT counseling center in Philadelphia called Erimin, which was short for Erotic Minorities. It was an early LGBTQ counseling center. But they also had been very involved in providing really the first generation of LGBTQ foster care in the 1970s. And so taking that moment in the past, right, from the 70s and 80s, when the city was actually seeking out LGBTQ foster parents to be foster parents for LGBTQ youth, and thinking about what was its resonance for now for the Supreme Court case. The challenges of those types of pieces is the stakes of it actually are quite high. And it, for me, really reveals the stakes of all of the research that we're doing, that these are stories that really matter. It's at moments like a Supreme Court case where the importance of that history really becomes clear and really important to share.
This ties into the next segment that I want to get into, which is that you are the director of the Public History Initiative at Cornell University. What are your roles and responsibilities as the director, and what do those day-to-day operations look like for the Public History Initiative?
So the Public History Initiative, I was essentially hired in fall of 2019 to start the Public History Initiative. And so it's only a few years old and it's still evolving. But in general, the goal of the Public History Initiative has been to try to build new conversations among students, faculty, and the wider communities at Cornell and in Ithaca and Tompkins County about the meanings of history for today, and to try to help students to understand, I think, the stakes of historical research and to understand historical knowledge as a process of production that is actually driven by both structures of power, right, that determine like whose stories get remembered or forgotten or erased, and the ethical demands of doing historical research now. And so I think that what we try to do in the Public History Initiative that's maybe different is really trying to engage students in direct historical research, right, through things like oral histories or archival practice in the libraries, and to also create work that's going to be public facing. So they have to think about, again, the structures of power and the ethical valences of the work that they're doing. The other thing I'll just say about that I really love about the Public History Initiative is trying to give students permission to have feelings about the historical work that they're doing. I'll say that the different kind of responsibilities or threads of the Public History Initiative, some of it are courses, some of it are public programs where we bring in speakers to talk about the public history or publicly engaged work that they're doing. Some are fellowships that we run with either with the History Center here in Tompkins County or the library to train students in different public history methods. And then finally, a website where we actually are able to share the research and work that students are doing.
Have you encountered any challenges with the initiative as the director?
Well, I'll say that one challenge is, I think a challenge that a lot of people, of course, faced is that, you know, I was here at Cornell for about 6 months when COVID started and the campus shut down. And I think, of course, COVID has really shaped a lot of what the Public History Initiative has done. I think, among other things, it led me to take the Public History Initiative in more digital directions than I maybe had anticipated. I think, especially coming out of the museum, a lot of the work I had done was in space, like in physical space. And so I think that the challenges of COVID led us to think about digital humanities more than maybe I had been anticipating. And I think that's been really meaningful and productive and actually has helped us to have a greater reach with the work that we're doing. The time the COVID was starting, I guess, so in fall of 2020, we were also launching an oral history fellowship with the History Center, where students were going to be trained in oral history methods and then go into the community to conduct interviews with people. And we decided with the History Center to focus on community responses to COVID-19 as a kind of rapid response oral history archiving. And that, I think, raised other types of challenges, you know, that were really meaningful challenges for students to think about, again, the emotional valences of the work that they're doing. Asking people for their personal stories challenged students to maybe bring more of themselves and work to try to create a space of trust where people are going to be open to sharing those intimate experiences.
You also mentioned the digitization projects, and I want to hear a little bit more about that, especially as COVID hastened this trend.
When COVID started, I was teaching a seminar at Cornell called Making Public Queer History, which is both about introducing students to LGBTQ history, but also to thinking about the politics of LGBTQ history making. And Cornell is an exciting place to do that work. Cornell was the university that had the second LGBTQ student group in the country. And the Human Sexuality Collection here at Cornell, curated by Brenda Marsden, It has a huge collection related to Cornell's LGBTQ student groups. The problem was, of course, we were about to go back into the archive for students to start doing some of that research when COVID started. So what we ended up doing instead that semester was relying on digitization of Cornell's newspaper, and students created a timeline of queer history at Cornell based on the newspaper records. And that's kind of interesting, again, to think about what shows up in the archive and what doesn't. We're now in the process of digitizing more of about 200 items from the Cornell LGBT Coalition that we're hoping to be able to use more of in the future. I mean, now we're able to get back into the archive more now, but we're just finishing up an exhibition, a digital exhibition on Cornell's queer history. I think one thing that's also interesting about doing this work in a university, you know, and through a class, is my expectation is also that this is going to be something that we'll continue to add on. Now that I've taught that Making Public Queer History class twice, right, that exhibit is the product of the work of many students over multiple classes that we can keep adding to and keep building on and keep adding new questions. And so I think it's interesting to think about digital exhibits as distinct from physical exhibits as something that can continue to grow and evolve in different ways.
Right. What were some of the fellowships and events where people come in and speak?
The programming has been really thrilling because most of it's been online now for the last 2 years, but we've been able to bring in people like Maria Loza, who's at Georgetown and had worked on the Bracero history project about the history of Mexican guest workers. We just had a wonderful lecture by Samantha Rosenthal, who has a new book called Living Queer History, about doing LGBTQ public history in a southern city in Roanoke, Virginia. And those programs have been really important, I think, for the community kind of generally to think about all the different forms that public history can take. But I think it's also been really important for our undergraduates and graduate students to hear people talking about often the personal reasons that they came to do this work, how their personal histories shape their scholarly research and their scholarly goals. In terms of fellowships, we're just also completing our first semester doing a public history fellowship with the Cornell University's Library's Rare and Distinctive Collections. And then we tried to do this as a different model where six students are each individually paired with a curator or archivist at the Cornell Library to work on a specific project with the goal of teaching them about archival methods and methods of library science, but also, again, thinking about the ethics of that work and the stakes of that work.
How was the public outreach perception towards this? Are you hoping to expand on that network more in the future?
The History Center here in Thomas County in Ithaca has really been a kind of crucial partner for us from the beginning, both creating things like an oral history fellowship, as well as many of our students going on to do internships there. My hope really for the future, and this is something that COVID has made more complicated, that I'm hoping we'll have more opportunities around going forward, is to build other partnerships with other community groups, right, that don't necessarily think of themselves as historical organizations, but have deep and really important histories in Ithaca for the community that we can help to build on, right, and to help people to share their stories. Our fellowship this last year focused on food and foodways in Tompkins County, thinking about the history of the restaurant industry and agriculture in Ithaca, and that's been really exciting to kind of keep building on. We're also working, I'll just say, to create a public history minor for undergraduates that will help to bring together a lot of the coursework that we're doing, right, and try to help students to think about this as kind of more consolidated set of questions that they're working through and think about how they might bring some of the questions we're asking locally about Ithaca and Thomas County and Cornell, but also to bridge out. We had a postdoctoral fellowship this semester, a postdoctoral fellow named Abakal Bora, who was teaching a class on apartheid and memory in South Africa. And that was, to me, a really wonderful example about thinking about similar questions about memory, about monuments, but in a different context. And again, our goal, I think, for the Public History Initiative is to connect locally. You know, and I think this is an important lesson for students about doing public history where you are and as a way of engaging with the communities around you, but also think about public history as a set of global questions that we can bring to all of the work and research that we're doing.
So where do you see the public history initiative in the future, and what do you hope to accomplish both near and long term?
You know, in the most immediate term, we're in the process of trying to have our public history minor approved, and I'm excited about that. I think we've gotten a lot of excitement from students in my introductory class to public history, monuments, museums, and memory. Students produce what we call archival finds, where they do research in the archive. They find one object, right, and they research it, and they write 250 words about it, and then we get to share it. And I just kind of want more of that, right? More opportunities for students to engage in archival research, to engage around oral history. And I think the public history minor will really help us to build a lot of excitement around that. And we're also having a lot of conversations here at Cornell about creating some kind of public humanities certificate for graduate students. I think that training in public humanities is really critical, I think increasingly critical for graduate students. And I think kind of more largely, I am hoping to think about the ways that public humanities and public history work can really also help scholars and communities broadly think about the significance of scholarship for the present. And so that's my hope for where the Public History Initiative might go.
And one final question I always like to ask historians engaged in public history work is about the future of public history. Where do you see it headed?
If you look at the history of public history programs, you know, a lot of them emerged in the 70s and 80s as kind of professional programs. And I think the kind of teaching of methods is, of course, really important. What I'm hoping for public history, and this is, I guess, the work that I want to do through the Public History Initiative, is to open up a larger conversation that scholars have been having about the ethics of public history, that I think we see a bit more centered in things like critical heritage studies, but really to bring these questions about ethics and power into training around public history. And I think also, and this is really coming, I think, from a lot of queer and feminist studies that I'm engaging with, to really think even more about affect and feeling, right? And to move our thinking about public history, not just in terms of transmission of knowledge, but also to think about feeling as a key framework through which we're engaging publics and building community. And I think that feeling is a really important lens through which to think about the partnerships that we're trying to build and the ethics of the work that we're doing.
Do you have any advice for students or others who may be listening to this and wanting to get into public history themselves or doing their own research project on public history? What advice would you give?
So I think one piece of advice I would give is if you feel excited about engaging with communities or you feel excited about sharing your work, to not wait to do it. If you have a sense like you're doing a research project and you have a sense like maybe oral histories might be a way to complement the work I'm doing, which depends, of course, on the time period you're looking at. But if you feel like maybe there's a space for oral history, to just try it and see what it's like and start to do it and see what you find. There are, of course, also really fantastic summer sessions and programs in oral history methods that people can take, like the VOCES program at UT Austin. There are lots of programs like this to engage in learning more about methods of oral history. And I'll say, I think that oral history, I think, is a really wonderful place for people interested in public history to start, because I think it engages you again in these critical questions about partnership and about sharing authority and about ethical frameworks and trust building and relationship building. But I think that the other piece I'll just say, and this was advice that one of our recent speakers, Amy Tsuyoshi from San Francisco State University, gave to our students, and that was not to let money be an obstacle, right? That it's really important, I think, to seek out funding, right? To support the work you're doing. And funding really helps, of course, to give energy and depth sometimes to the work that you're doing, but not to let that be an obstacle. That even if you're not doing an oral history project, right? To do things like interviewing your own family members about your family history. I think those are important ways in order to ask your family about their own archives and think about things like your own family archives or community archives. Are there things from your family archive or your community archives that might be a great source of a story? Or to think about maybe there's something you want to write about, even if it's just for Twitter or just for a blog, right, that there are stories that we might have an opportunity to share. I think that's what I mean about, I guess, not waiting for the right moment to do it, but that when a story is urgent, the right moment is now.
Absolutely. And frankly, I can speak to the same reason. If you have something you want to do, don't hesitate. Just do it. I wanted to thank you again, Dr. Vedder, for your time. Thank you so much for such a great responses. Hearing about your work, it's been really fascinating to hear.
Thank you so much, Tim. It's been really such a great pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
For our listeners here, if you are interested in hearing more about Dr. Vedder or his work, you can visit his academic page at history.cornell.edu/Stephen-Vedder or his personal website, www.stephenvedder.com. For more information for public history at Cornell, visit phi.history.cornell.edu. Once again, thank you to Stephen Vedder for your time and have a great day.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Public Historians at Work. You can show your support for this podcast and the Center for Public History through a donation at giving.uh.edu/public history. For more information about the diverse work of the Center for Public History, find us online at uh.edu/class/CPH or on Facebook and Twitter at UHCP History. Remember, we are all keepers of our history.